start by just saying your name and maybe the unit you were in when you served?
Okay. My name is Raymond L. Tollett, Jr. I went into the service in November of 70 as a second lieutenant. Do you want to go through all that or just want the Vietnam portion?
No, I'd love that.
Okay, well, I tricked myself into going into the service. I graduated from high school in 1966. I went to the University of Texas. And by high school, I went to New Mexico Military Institute in Roswell, New Mexico. And so I was 17 when I graduated from high school. And in 1966, being an ROTC was not near the hassle it was in later years. And so I decided to continue on then. And I remember I had to get my father to sign a waiver because I was under the age of 18. And so I did my junior and senior ROTC years while I was a freshman and sophomore.
Okay.
And so when I got out of ROTC, that would have been in 68, that was at the height of the war. And at that time, there were no deferments at all, unless you were going to be a minister or a doctor. But I didn't have to worry because I had two more years of college. And so those were what I call my junior and senior year, my drugstore hippie years. And I had at the time afro hair because my hair is real curly and it stuck out. I did have hair in those days. And I would have to check in once a month. And unbeknownst to me, that was when all the radicals started harassing all the ROTC people at their grills and so forth.
Okay.
Of course, I really wasn't aware of it because I wasn't involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
I was strictly there as a drugstore hippie, you know, trying to pick up women, as in the strawberry statement. But I would check in once a month.
So this was a 2S deferment, is what it's called?
I don't know what it was. I was still in school.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, I'd have to check in once a month, and in order to do that, I had to walk through the entire length of the ROTC building in Texas. And I know I used to get these strange looks, obviously, because I'd look like some sort of hippie coming in there to check in.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, that was neither here nor there. I got out, and when I graduated from college, I pinned on my bars. But getting back to the original story, I mean, my information was 2 years out of date. So I knew that I didn't want to be in the reserves, but at the time, Texas was one of the few ROTC programs in the nation that had branch ROTC instead of just general ROTC.
What is that?
Well, in other words, they had a branch for infantry, branch for artillery,
okay.
Transportation Corps, military police, maybe something else, but I was in the Transportation Corps, and I really wanted to be in the Transportation Corps. And so I know that it took forever to get the paperwork, and I remember I was back just messing around, and I was, if I got out in May, it was probably July. I got some paperwork, went back home to Big Spring where I lived, and I remember sitting there thinking, okay, they said, we're sorry you can't be in the Transportation Corps, you can't go active duty. We can put you in the reserves. Of course, I figured I didn't really want to spend 8 years in the reserves.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what I thought. So I did have enough sense to know that I didn't want to pick infantry or artillery or armor in places you get hurt. So I picked quartermaster and signal corps, and lo and behold, they sent me back notice that congratulations, you've got 2 years active duty in quartermaster corps. Report to Fort Lee, Virginia, and sometime in November 1970. That's fine, so I showed up there and I went through basic, officer's basic there, and then I went through POL, advanced POL training. That's my branch or my subspecialty in the military.
What does that stand for, POL?
Petroleum oil and lubricants.
Okay.
Run the tank farms and tank trucks and the barges and that kind of thing. And so then I had basically about 6 months at Fort Lee, and then I spent 6 months at Fort Sill up in Lawton, Oklahoma.
What were you doing for the 6 months at Fort Lee?
Fort Lee was in quartermaster training.
Okay.
And then Fort Sill, they put me in as an executive officer of the headquarters company, the ghost headquarters company. We were across the highway in this old World War II barracks area that just had mass, it was just a storage area, really, or just everything was mothballed, but they had to have a company headquarters there. And so I was the executive officer of this headquarters company. We had no real troops under our command or anything. We were just there, mm-hmm. holding slot, really. Anyway, during that period of time, I'd come to Dallas because I had friends here from college. And I remember going over to a place, I forget the street, it was a bar called Cardinal Puffs. It was over somewhere in the SMU area on west, east of Central and west of Greenville. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting over there drinking beer, and I was talking to a kid who just got out of A&M, and he was in the Corps. And he told me, or maybe he had been out a while, but the point is we're basically contemporaries. And at that time he told me, I told him my story, and he said, "Oh, you fool, there are so many officers now that we are all going into a reserve unit in St. Louis, and we'll never have to make a meeting. We're not assigned anybody. They just have to take us until they can get rid of us." And so basically, not knowing the full facts of the situation, if I'd taken the transportation corps deal, I could have gone to transportation basic at Fort Eustis and then not have to worry about going to Vietnam or not have to worry about going into a reserve unit for 8 years.
Oh, really?
So being too smart by half, I got myself sent to the jungles. And so I went over to Vietnam in November of 71 and came home 11 months later in October of 72.
Okay. You went to the military institute in high school. Was your father in World War II? Do you have a military history? Or
no, I was raised in Big Spring, Texas, and my father thought I was hanging around with a bad bunch of people, so off to school I went.
Okay, I understand that. So you were in the ROTC, I guess, kind of before the Students for a Democratic Society and all those people really harassing the those people.
Mm-hmm. Before all this really got cranking. I mean, Kent State and all that happened my senior year.
Right.
So I was out of it. But, that's when I was playing drugstore hippie.
Yeah.
So I really had no run-in with any of the protesters while I was in ROTC.
Okay. So you were at Texas from 66 to 70?
Mm-hmm.
And then you went right after school, pretty much?
Pretty much. I mean, graduated in May of 70, went to the service in November of 70.
Okay. What were your feelings about Vietnam? I know that, a lot of it was in the news before you went over there. What'd you think of the war?
Oh, I thought the war was necessary. It's a shame that it was handled the way it was. I think and history shows that after we were actually run out or quit, that it turned into a huge fiasco for those people.
Mm-hmm.
And that could have been avoided if we had stayed and helped the South Vietnamese and done what we're doing in Iraq today.
Yeah.
So I had no problem going. I surely didn't want to get shot, and I was I had no training at all. I mean, I have never shot an M16.
Really?
When I was in ROTC boot camp at Fort Sill, I qualified as an expert in rifle, on the rifle, but it was an M14.
Okay.
And when I was in military school and in high school, we had M14.
So they were still training people with the M14s up until 1970?
Yeah. Probably not to 70. I mean, I went to Fort Sill for ROTC boot camp in the summer of 67,
mm-hmm.
between my junior and senior ROTC years.
Okay.
And that's when we only had M14s.
Huh.
We had no M16s. I've never shot one. And I you know, and then so they basically sent me into combat or put me in a combat zone without any training on an M16, which is the only weapons they had.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to use a 45, even though I had to carry one periodically when I did guard duty or payroll and mm-hmm. so forth. And so it was really a fiasco. I mean, I don't know what they were thinking, but nevertheless, they sent me over there.
Wow. I think a lot of it's kind of a fiasco, and there's kind of stuff like that. It seems like jumping up all over the place where there's just a lack of coordination and kind of didn't know what they were doing.
Well, they know what they're doing. I mean, you got to remember, I was kind of, this kind of oddball situation. You know, I wasn't an infantry person. You know, I didn't go to infantry school, and I'm sure if I'd done one of the combat arms, I would have been fully trained. You know, yeah. I was basically sent over there as a,
yeah.
And even at Fort Sill or Fort Lee, when quartermaster, they, you know, we didn't have to do that. I mean, they gave us M14s with cheap blanks with. I mean, there was
really.
So it was, you know, when we'd go on quote maneuvers and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, I guess so. When did you get into Vietnam? When did you get into the country?
November of 70, I don't recall. The first part of November, I feel sure, but it's, you know, it's some, we'll just call it the first, you know, first week of November 1970.
Okay. Where were you stationed?
I was stationed in Long Bend, which is, you probably know, is that huge military base that was just east of Saigon.
Okay.
And that's where everybody went in, well, not everybody, I think maybe everybody at that point in time was probably going into Benoit Air Base, and then you were transferred to the replacement depot in Long Bend to be shipped out. Because I know some of the guys that I went over with in my unit, I know Fagerhold, as a matter of fact, a guy named Bruce Fagerhold lives up in Hoopole, North Dakota. We went in to San Francisco a couple of days early, then we flew out of Travis, and I know he went there, but he ended up in Da Nang, I think. I haven't kept up with him. But so I think at that point everybody was going into Benoit or Tonsonute, actually. And then you were put up in Long Bend for, you know, in-country briefing and shots and whatever, and then you were dispersed out. And
so you went to the repo depot, and they assigned you something, and there you went?
There I went, and I was assigned, much to my relief and happiness, to the 512 Quartermaster Company, which is a petroleum oil and lubricant company that ran the tank yards or the tank farm at Long Bend. So I at least got to do what I was trained to do, which I was amazed that they could have put me behind a tank or maybe go build bridges or something, you know.
Yeah.
So I was with that basic unit all the way through. I mean, when I got there, I started out as the youngest lieutenant, so they put me in charge of the tank, drum yard, where they have, you know, to transport a lot of fluid, or whether it be oil or gasoline and so forth, into certain situations. They put in the 55-gallon metal drums,
mm-hmm.
so they could put them on trucks and so forth, and so they had these huge stacks. And that's, you know, I was there, did that for about 3 months, and I know, much to my surprise, I used to go out, you know, I was always told that if you're going to lead men, and you're supposed to be able to do what they do and go with them. You just can't, you know, if you got a call at 3 o'clock in the morning to get up and go load a bunch of trucks, you didn't call the sergeant and say, go men, get the men, go out there and do it. You went with them.
Yeah.
And of course, apparently, my predecessors there, the older lieutenants, or the ones that have been there longer, had never done that, and they got all upset about this. But it served me well, because about 3 months later, one of the areas that this company had, this 512 Quartermaster Company, was we were in charge of receiving the tankers on the Saigon River at a place called Da Bay, which was south of Saigon, and it was down on the Saigon River, as I said. It was near a little town called Da Bay, which is a U.S. Navy base. And the lieutenant, or rather the captain in charge of the company, was apparently well impressed with me, and so he decided to appoint me as the new unit commander down there over these other more senior lieutenants, which
wow.
didn't they were all upset about it.
And you were 23 at the time, or?
Well, I don't want to see. I went to 17. Well, I'm early 20s. And it's not, you know, it's not so much the age. It's just the fact that
experience.
Well, some lieutenant had to go down there.
Yeah.
Because the guy that was there was coming home back to the States, and so they had to fill the slot. And so rather than pick a senior guy to go to this cushy job,
okay,
the guy picked me, and I guess it's because I showed some sort of, what's the word, initiative when I'd go out with my men and, you know, load the drums and stuff and worked at the tank farm or the drum yard as opposed to sitting somewhere drinking coffee and letting the sergeants do it.
Yeah.
So it was a pretty cushy deal. I mean, I've tried to describe it to other people, but what you had were three tank farms on the river. Caltex, which is California Texaco at the time. They had Esso, which is now Exxon. And then they had Shell. And they all, we took product at all of the three tank farms. And we, the unit, 14 men, we lived in three villas at the Caltex tank farm. And we would go to the Navy base to eat, and they had, you know, good food down there, or we had our own kitchen, we could cook our own food.
Mm-hmm.
And then we daily would go to Shell for, well, that's where the offices were. And so then I had men that were stationed at each of the tank farms to take, they would gauge when the tanker would come in, they would verify, you know, the amount on board and the amount left, so that we'd verify that if we, you know, 500,000 gallons of diesel fuel, that we got it. And then we also were in charge of monitoring the trucks that went out to do, it was all civilian contractors, and the trucks that went out to the various units, you know, we oversee their filling. And of course that was later on I explained that that was a big mess. But nevertheless, that was what we were supposed to be doing. So it was, you know, completely out of combat. You know, it was a pretty lush assignment. You know, you could go into Saigon anytime, you could catch a ride or whatever you wanted to do. And nobody breathing down your neck.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that lasted for about 6 months or so. And then the drawdown was taking place, and the major... trying to think if I was still on the 512. The 512 may have folded into the 624th S&S company at that time. Nevertheless, I was still doing the job.
Mm-hmm.
And that company was assigned to some transportation battalion just for paperwork purposes, and the bull colonel running the battalion or regiment, whatever, some colonel in transportation decided to make a little visit down to our place and got so upset that he, about how we were living, and even though we were doing our job, that he just didn't like the idea that we were down there in this cushy assignment, so he moved us all back to Longview.
Really?
Yeah. And so therefore, I stayed
what,
there.
What did he say to y'all when he came
in?
He
just, you know, he just said, this is ridiculous. You can't, I mean, you got to remember, you're sitting in my den, right? This is about 20 by 40 feet.
Mm-hmm.
My bedroom is this size.
At the villa?
Yeah.
Now, these villas, were they like indigenous to Vietnam, or had they been built by the Army?
No, they'd been built by Caltex.
Okay.
For their employees back in the 30s and 40s before World War II.
Oh, okay. Okay. And he just didn't like the fact that
you know,
y'all
some,
had
some
army,
you know, some first lieutenant with 14 guys were down there just having a good old time.
Yeah. So he sent y'all away.
You know, he just closed up shop, moved us back to Longview, which is fine. And got back there, and I remember in Longview, they're shutting that place down too. And my office in Longview was that of at one time, apparently pretty high ranked. I don't know, I think probably a colonel's office, because it was huge. And it had its own bunker and the whole works. I mean, it was just, you know, there was lots of space available.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're, you know, they're shutting down the war.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, when I left in November of 70, or October 71, what did I tell you, 72, October 72, it was my understanding that there was only one company of infantry, U.S. infantry, left in Vietnam. Everybody else was supply and support.
Yeah.
And even at that time, they were shutting down Long Binh. We had turned over Long Binh to the Vietnamese. So it was quite a, you could just have your pick of quarters and, office space or whatever. So it was not quite the same as it had been 4 years earlier.
This is part of the Vietnamization or Vietnamization.
Yeah.
Did y'all have much contact with the Arvin?
Nope. Not with the military. I mean, we had the, obviously the drivers and the people working at the tank farms.
Mm-hmm.
But no, we didn't do much with the military at all. I mean, that wasn't our job.
Yeah.
And trying to think. What else? Well, I guess I'll just go through the thing just step by step. So anyway, I leave Long Binh, and I go to Na Be, the little unit, the Caltex tank farm in Shell, and SO.
Mm-hmm.
And I get there before the guy I'm replacing actually leaves, so I don't get his quarters yet. I had to spend a couple of days in another room in one of the other buildings. And, of course, nobody told me at all that there was a battery, a 105 battery of South Vietnamese stationed across the fence, and that was in the Delta area. What they would do is they would just arbitrarily fire rounds throughout the night.
Yeah.
To and they just they shoot to places that they knew or thought there may be enemy.
Uh-huh.
But they didn't have any target. They just arbitrarily fire. Well, you know, the first night I'm there, these guns start going off, and it just scares the hoosh out of me. I didn't know if we were under attack. I didn't know. And it was dark, and I didn't have a gun. And I didn't know where anybody else was. And I didn't want to make a fool of myself around all these, you know, corporals and sergeants. So I just kind of gutted it out till the next morning and found out that, oh, don't worry about it, Lieutenant. They were just firing randomly. And so that job lasted, like I said, for 6 months. And it was quite nice. While I was there, towards the end, we had this big stink. Apparently, the truck drivers were very good about trying to siphon away fuel and steal fuel from the trucks, and then they would take them and sell it on the black market.
These were the South Vietnamese?
Right, the contract laborers.
Okay.
That drove from either Shell or SO or whatever. And my men knew what was going on. And they could tell, you know, about, you know, what they'd do is they'd have, one example would be like a container in the tank.
Mm-hmm.
And so what would happen is that you would fill the tank up, be like a open cup inside of a tank. So it would fill up, but when he went to whatever unit he was delivering the fuel to, he would offload his tank, but that container held fuel that wasn't offloaded. He had a separate way. Then he would go somewhere like sales and drain it and then sell that to the black market.
Really?
Yeah. And so they had a big investigation. And we.
How much typically could they get in a...
Well, they couldn't take... I mean, you were looking at 500-gallon tankers, and so they probably were taking, you know, 50 gallons or something. I mean, but it was enough. I mean, you know, when that's... You do it once
right.
a day.
Right.
And you couldn't short them too much, because if you had some at the other end spec of 500 gallons, then, you know, they had a 500 gallon tank and it came up only half, then, you know, it would be pretty obvious.
Yeah.
But it was quite the thing. And so we had this, I remember they had the military intelligence people out of D.C. came in and investigated and did all this stuff. And I remember going over there and spilling the beans and had my men go over and spill the beans. And when they left, this one colonel, he said, "Son, I wish you'd never opened your mouth, because I don't want to have to go write this up and explain it." So that was interesting. And, you know, I'd sit in my office and have to do the paperwork. You know, I'd shop the Paysex catalog and place orders for stereo equipment, some of which I still have back down there.
Oh, wow.
And like I say, it was it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
Used to make beer runs going into Saigon to Thompson Newt a couple. I never really cracked. I mean, I don't know if my guys smoked dope or not. I don't think any of them were on heroin, but I didn't go into their barracks. That's another thing that Curley, you know, when he came, I was telling you about the guy from Transportation Corps that came in, and he went through all the rooms, and I never did that. I figured it was there, it was what they did in private, as long as they got up in the morning and did their business.
Right.
And anyway, a lot of them were probably had some marijuana in there, or some kind of dopey little rooms, you know, with
some tie-dye on
tie-dye
the wall.
On the wall and that kind of stuff, you know. And so, you know, anyway, that set him off, too. But what was I saying? Oh, well, some of them didn't drink, so I'd get their beer ration cards.
Two cases a month, is that correct?
Probably, that sounds about right. And so I'd get their beer ration cards, and we'd go in and make a beer run into, especially when I found out they had good beer in Thompson. Every once in a while, we'd get a load of Olympia, which I don't know whether you know Olympia or beer, but back in those days, it was truly made in Rainier, Washington. It was equivalent to Coors, and it was not, it was by itself. I mean, it wasn't part of a big brewery.
Okay.
And it was good stuff. So when I found out they had Olympia there, I'd go in and sock up cases of stuff. And then we'd have, at night, we'd go get films. I don't know how they got them. I guess they went in sock up and got films. We had our own film projector, you know, 16-millimeter film projector, and we'd watch movies in the living area outside my bedroom at night. Then on the weekends, we'd have cookouts among the green grass and bougainvilleas.
Yeah.
And we could get... The Vietnamese apparently do not like white meat.
Don't like what?
White meat, on chicken white meat.
Okay.
And so when they... You know, of course, all this stuff was freshly frozen, stolen from the commissary.
Yeah.
So we bought it on the black market, but it was all U.S., you know, rations that they'd stolen from the commissaries.
Who had stolen it from the...
The Vietnamese.
Okay.
And then we'd buy it on the black market, and we'd get hamburger meat and chicken, and they'd throw in the white meat. So we bought it, you know, if you bought thighs and legs and wings, you pay for that, they'd throw in the breast.
Really?
Yeah. So we'd have cookouts on the weekend.
It's a little different than it is here, I guess.
Yeah. So, you know, it was a pretty good life. And, trying to think of anything other than that big. Oh, that was and during that period of time is when the heathens tried to blow up my ski boat. That kind of upset me.
You had a ski boat?
I did. We, as I said, Na Bay, the little town that we were stationed near.
So y'all were on the Saigon River.
We were in the tank farms, which were on the river.
Okay,
because that's where the tankers came. And down a little further down, maybe a couple miles down, was a little town called Na Bay. It's on the maps, still there today.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a Navy base there. Matter of fact, Jim Marsh, who I guess you ought to, when you're here over Christmas, you'll want to, I'll introduce you to him. He was a swift boat driver. You know, the river rats?
Yeah.
And Black Carey?
Okay.
And he was stationed there at not the same time I was.
Well, what kind of, can you describe that boat? What it would be like?
Well, I don't know what a swift boat is. It would look like an old World War II PT boat, I think.
Okay.
But anyway, the bottom line is they had some flat-bottom boats there that looked like they reminded me of like some sort of bass boat or something that you see nowadays.
Yeah.
So my NCO, my head NCO, Sergeant Beal, went down, and we decided we want one of those. So he went down there and got one somehow. And he got it rigged with 250-horsepower Mercury engines. And he got it up to our place at the Caltex where we live. And this took a while because we had to get, you know, I don't know what he did, what strings he pulled or whatever. But anyway, we got the boat, we got it running, got the thing in, tied it up at the pier. And it happened to be next to a big tanker. And that night, the Vietnamese tried to blow that tanker up, the Kong. And they sent floated mines down the river. And they went off prematurely, so it didn't really damage anything. But what happened is...
They're trying to blow what up? The boat?
The tanker.
Oh, the tanker.
In other words, we were tied up next to a big tanker.
Uh-huh.
That's where he tied up. I hadn't gotten out, been able to go out on the boat yet.
Yeah.
So we tied up, and then that night, the Vietnamese sent some mines down to blow up a tanker, which we were berthed next to. I mean, you know, a huge ship, a little bitty flat-bottom boat. Uh-huh. And that tanker started... what would you call it, moving side to side, wallowing, you know, because of the water pressure of the concussion, and it swamped the ski boat and sunk it. So that was the end of the ski boat deal.
So did you ever get to go skiing on it?
No, never. It was sunk the day we got it.
Did y'all have trouble with the VC coming in trying to?
That was the only time.
Really?
Yeah, there. And later on, back in Longview, they tried to blow up a few. They blew up the tank farm and stuff, but I'll get to that in a minute. So anyway, here we're in. So I'm in Nave and living is good. Life's easy.
Yeah. You know?
And so we get, the colonel makes us all go back to Long Bend. And so I'm there maybe 9 months already in Vietnam, 8 to 9 months. So I'm back in Long Bend, and that's when there was an attack. And at this point in time, we had turned, the military had turned the tank farm and the drum yard over to civilian contractors, PG&E, I think they're. It was very similar to, who's the one that is in all the trouble in Iraq now? There's an old Brown & Root company, one that Cheney was in.
Halliburton?
Halliburton, yeah. It's a very similar concept to Halliburton. I can't remember if it might have been a Brown & Root or a whatever. It was a civilian contractor. They had it. And I was tasked to make that turnover from the civilian contractors to the South Vietnamese during that period of time. And they didn't, and there was lots of paperwork involved. But in somehow involved in there, the Viet Cong came in and blew up. They blew up the barge offloading facility on Long Bend, and they blew up a couple of the tanks.
Really?
And it was a real light show.
Yeah.
And so we had to divert for several weeks before we got the things, especially the barge loading. They'd send barges in from, actually we'd load them in Nave, and we'd send them into Long Bend up a smaller river, and then they'd offload it. There's a pump station. They'd offload the barges and via pipelines fill up the tanks at the tank farm. And so when they blew that up, we had to start diverting all this fuel by tank truck. You know.
Now, were they able to get it because it had kind of been transferred into civilian territory and there wasn't any protection around
it? More than likely.
Yeah.
No one, I never heard, you know, what went on. It was just, you know, a lack of security.
Yeah.
But people were thinking it's, you know, the war's over, everything's under control, you know, they're not around.
Yeah.
They're behind the lines, that kind of thing. So, anyway, we had to run the tank trucks for several weeks until they got the barge thing fixed up, and it was very interesting. I called the guy that Shell, actually Shell did most of the distribution work by tankers, tank trucks, and I'm trying to remember the guy's name. I saw him after the war, and he was worked for Shell, and he had a nice place in downtown Saigon too. Anyway, he was real nice, and we worked out a deal where we were run the tank trucks, and, you know, and then about the time we got that working well and getting them through the gates, then they got the pumps working again, so we canceled that. It was that, and then the turnover, I remember I had to make a command decision. There was a lot of shortages. The Vietnamese didn't want to take it in because they couldn't find a bunch of product they're supposed to have, and the people, the civilian contractors said that we don't have it. We never had it, and it was just a fiasco, and I just said, I just told them to write it off, just get this thing transferred, get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm on some sort of document somewhere fraudulently asserting that the product was there.
So is that it? And then you went, is that the last of it?
Well, I mean, and then after that particular, you know, then I came back. I was supposed to go, got out a month early, was assigned to Hood. But they just had to have some place to send me, and I never went there. I mustered out in San Francisco, signed the paperwork, you know, got out, came on back to Dallas. I'm trying to think. Oh, there's a couple funny things. You were allowed 2 weeks leave.
Uh-huh.
You know, everybody had your 2 weeks leave every year. And then you had an extra week of R&R, which did not count towards leave. And so during this period of time that I was over there, I took my first R&R or leave. I went to Japan.
Really?
Which was interesting in and of itself. But for some reason, that was, even though Japan was not an R&R station at the time, somebody in the clerk's office or somewhere in the hierarchy said that that was an R&R. So when I got back and when I started looking into it, I still had 2 weeks leave.
Really?
So even though I knew that I didn't, they had supposedly, had, so I could take it, you know, they didn't know about it.
Yeah.
So I took 2 weeks and I went to Bali and Indonesia. So when I was mustered out of the Army, I remember, this is really funny, there was this officious little twerp that was telling me, he said, "Lieutenant, you took an extra week's leave that you shouldn't have taken, and we're going to have to dock your pay a week." And I looked at him and I said, "Son, you could have kept all my pay if I could have been on leave the entire time."
So what did you do in Bali and Japan?
Well, in Japan, I went in and spent some time in Tokyo. Then I went down to Osaka, which, you know,
Did you go by yourself, or were there?
No, I went by myself.
Okay.
And just, you know, I stayed in one of those guest houses or whatever and walked around the old palaces and so forth.
Cool.
And then when I went to Bali, I went to Bangkok for a while, did the sex tourist thing there, and then went to Bali and spent a little over a week there just hanging out. And because I was uninformed, I didn't realize of all the, I was on the part of the island which was, it did have some tourists, but they were older. And apparently on the other side of Bali, and I didn't realize this, that's where those famous beaches are, where all the Australians come and they just go crazy. It's like Padre Island.
Okay.
And so I missed all that. That's where I should have been, but no one told me about that. I was in some state guest house somewhere in the hills. And it was nice, but, it, you know, I kind of missed out on all that.
Yeah. How often would y'all go into Saigon for unofficial R&R?
You know, weekly.
Yeah.
Every couple of days. I mean, you know, depending, I'd get a hankering for Mexican food, and I'd get my driver to drive me into Saigon. We'd go to the Mexican restaurant there, nachos, enchiladas, and then, you know, I'd do some business and come back, and, you know, just whatever.
Yeah. Was Saigon kind of, there were troops everywhere kind of going to bars and...
I guess. I didn't do much of that. I didn't go in at night. I did go see one pub. I saw Dewey Foster one time, but that was... just a one-time deal. I didn't like to spend the night in Saigon. I really had no place to stay, and I figured it'd be better to be back home.
Yeah.
If you wanted to get laid, you could go down to Nava, and they had whorehouses down there. So. Then you go sleep in your own bed.
Did you ever do that? Go to the whorehouse?
Yes. Sure.
Did everybody?
Everybody was in my unit did.
Yeah. So it's a pretty fun time over there.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So. You know, and then of course, obviously, you didn't have that. You didn't when you were back in Long Bend. It was kind of locked in. You just stayed in Long Bend, unless you had a reason to go into Saigon. Actually, I did. I went to that. I wish I could remember that guy from Shell's name. He went to a big party at his house one time. They had this huge pool. I've got pictures of them. I wish they're all up in the those quarters up there, covered up and stuff. I couldn't get them out, but there was a picture of me and this bosomless bucks. Vietnamese girl. I remember I just got drunk as a skunk. Somebody had to drive me home. But that was, you know, got through it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot easier for me than it was for a lot of them.
Yeah. So you came back Dallas and hit the ground running and got a job and...
Well, I came back and applied for law school. And actually, I got back, immediately moved to Aspen. Rented an apartment in Aspen for about a month and then bought a condo And I lived up there through the ski season. And then I came, and while I was there, I took the LSAT in Boulder, applied to various law schools, got into St. Mary's and San Antonio, came back, rented the condo in the summer, came back to Big Spring, worked in a lawyer's office for a month or so, then moved to San Antonio, went to law school. Got married at the end of my first year in law school, and my wife, and then with the first gasoline crisis came, and she knew that no one would be ever going to Aspen, so we sold the condo in Aspen and, you know, lost money. One of the few people in the world that's ever lost money on real estate in Aspen.
And, so, yeah, I bet that's right.
Yeah.
Your men that you that worked under you, did you still keep up with them, or?
I don't.
Did you immediately after, or?
No.
Really?
Actually, the only people I ever kept up with to any form of degree were the guys that I went to quartermaster basic with. I was saying that Bruce Fagerhoe. Mm-hmm. And I had written him for years. I mean, we used to communicate once in a while about Christmas or something. Mm-hmm. But, no, the other guys, I don't know whatever happened to them. I guess it's just one of those things. Just they were that close of friends.
Yeah.
Had their own lives.
Yeah.
And, of course, the enlisted guys, you never were that close to anyway, so. And,
in the years after, have you gone back and thought about Vietnam and read anything or kind of taken a scholarly approach and done anything like that, or have you just kind of tried to?
Well, I've read, you know, several books about it, not Bright and Shining Lie, and I've got several in there about Vietnam, but it's just general military history, or I'm not really into all unit tactics and
right.
all that kind of stuff, so I didn't do that, you know. Mm-hmm. I was over there basically as a gas pumper, so. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I'm not, and I'd like to go back up. Steve Hanna is also a Vietnam vet. Do you? I don't know how many more vets you want to interview, but I know a couple here at Dan anyway.
You're my one, the one and only.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Well, no war stories for me.
That's all right. It's all part of it.
Yeah. But there are a couple other guys, if anybody else from Tech needs to do it. I mean, like I said, Jim Marsh was drove the swift boats, and Steve Hanna was the MP. And your dad, I know your dad knows Hanna. I don't know whether he knows Marsh or not, but it'd be easy enough to get somebody an interview with him. They both don't mind talking about it.
Really?
They're not shell shocked or anything.
Do you have a lot of friends that are veterans still?
No, very few people I know in Dallas. I mean, it's unusual. Well, it's not unusual because my age, you didn't go in the Army.
Yeah.
You were a graduate of Highland Park High School.
Right.
I'm sure there were a few, but that very it was not considered
so
a thing to do.
Working class war more than anything.
I think it was draftee war.
Yeah.
If you were got a college deferment, you didn't have to worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, get in college and keep on going.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's about it. Do you have any other stories or anything that you didn't tell?
Oh, I mean, let's see. I know that there's the infamous 45, and that just reflects badly on me, but I'll tell the story. I told you earlier, I was never trained on 45.
Uh-huh.
Then there's no excuse for what happened, but I had to make payroll. I had to go out and pay the civilian employees. And you had to be armed. And so somebody issued me a 45 and a clip of ammo.
Mm-hmm.
And I put the thing in there, but I didn't have it loaded. And so when I was coming back from payroll, I went to the office. And it was late. I wanted to get over to the Oak Club to get a beer and a pizza. And I don't know what. I know that I have a tendency when I'm hunting with my shotgun, at the end of the day or when you're going to, just sit down and rest or whatever, you come back to the car and you unload or whatever, always take the shells out of bottom. And then, you know, you do this, and but to make sure, you know, pump, I use a pump.
Yeah.
So I pump it to make sure it's, you know, you get the gel out and make sure everything's out.
Right.
And then click the trigger, you know, because you want to be able to pump it the next time. You don't want to leave the cock.
Yeah.
Well, what I did was I walked back to the office and I pulled that 45 out. Fortunately, I had the thing pointed to the floor, and I slid the slide back, forgetting that I had a clip in there.
So you put one in the chamber?
Put one in the chamber, and I pulled the trigger and it fired. It hit the concrete floor, went through the wall of the Posen Hut, and there was a captain in there that was going home in 3 days, and he was in one of those office chairs that has four legs,
uh-huh. You know,
and he was leaning back. Okay? So he had these legs up.
Yeah.
And that shell hit one of those legs and ricocheted out through the wall of the building out to the grass.
Wow.
And so, obviously, after the shock wore off, I was called in by the commanding officer of that area, who at the time it was a little colonel. The general was apparently somewhere else, so this was the assistant commander.
Uh-huh.
And after a royal chewing out, he made me for the next month go to every changing of the guard in Long Bend to give lectures on the care and feeding of the 45.
That's pretty funny.
Well, yeah. I mean, just thank God I didn't kill anybody.
Yeah. Or
anybody.
That's a pretty close call for it to go off and...
Oh, yeah. Just
nearly nick him.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm trying to think of anything else. I mean, I told you about the Steve-O.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to set a tone.
You know, in talking to you, I'm surprised at how much fun, you know, it sounds like it could have been.
Oh, yeah.
That it was... actually a really good time at some points.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's just it was a pain in the butt to be away from, you know, over there. And, you know, there is the fact that you were in Vietnam and could have been killed. I mean, you know, there were... But,
right.
No, they didn't... it wasn't anywhere near as bad as it could have been.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just very lucky to have the job I did and being able to be down in those villas for a good portion of the time. And,
mm-hmm.
And then... at the end in Long Bend, where it was starting to shut down, you know, nobody gave you any grief or anything, and you just went on about your business. And, you know, had, you know, some supervision. They had to be some, you had to be assigned to somebody, but I ran my own unit, essentially. And mm-hmm. No one knew what I did, so I just did what I needed to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, my captain, who was a, I can't remember his name now, I mean, he was just... You know, I met him once or twice. I mean, he didn't really know me, and I didn't know him. I was just assigned to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was nice to have that ability to just act on your own, to be your own boss.
I'm sure.
And so.
Do you think the experiences that you had over there prepared you for everything that you, I mean, for
well, I mean, I'm
work
sure it,
and
it gave you a certain amount of
responsibility and...
where you knew you could act on your own, you weren't.
Yeah.
You took responsibility and you did the job and you did it by yourself. You weren't just, you know, part of a cog. So that was good.
Yeah.
And you know, at least I knew I could do it. You know, if I had to, I wasn't, you know, always under somebody's thumb.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm not saying I'd go back, but you know, I guess I'm glad I went. And it is a shame. I know I have this real close friend down in Houston that I really admire. I mean, this guy, we grew up together in Big Spring, and his family was just dirt poor.
Mm-hmm.
And he put himself through Texas Engineering and has his own engineering company down in Houston and employs about 300 people and is very successful. And he told me one time we were out hunting, he said, you know, the only thing that I wish I'd have done was gone to Vietnam.
Really?
So I don't know whether that feeling is that widespread or not. And of course, you got to remember this is after Iraq and all the hoo-ha and, you know, the support your troops and, you know, the brave warriors. We weren't treated that way.
Yeah, it wasn't that way at all for y'all.
And so it may be just overwhelming patriotism got him. I don't know if he really feels that way. But I don't
yeah.
know how many of my general, I've never asked your dad. I've never asked, you know, it's not mine, but it's not my business why he didn't do it. You know, and I don't mm-hmm. know about... I know Wolf didn't want to go.
I don't see Wolf going at all.
No, actually, Wolf claims he did two tours in Vietnam. He was in ROTC apparently at one point in his life and went to the Vietnamese embassy twice, and so he figured he was on enemy soil.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That sounds about right. Boy.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for the interview.
And yeah.
Thank you for your service.
Well, I appreciate you coming back.
Yeah.
And again, if you want to, or if anybody else needs interviews, Jim Morris and Stevens.
Hello.
Yeah,
how are you?
Talette.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I can get them to cough up their stories, and they probably have much more war stories, I mean, true war stories, than I have.
Yeah.
But did you show Patrick the book you're reading?
What?
Something about toads and grunts or something.
Oh, well, that's just current. That's just
about
the current military. Hog pilots and blue water.